Hey everyone, welcome to episode 9 of the Shared Experience Podcast. Today's guest, Paul Drake, a founding father of our Zeta Lambda chapter at Cal State Chico. When it comes to the ability to experience cycling events, Paul has literally done it all. He's a 7-time Pi Alpha, ranging from 1989 to 2005. He's done all 3 routes in Journey Hope, and he's done Gear Up Florida 1 year. Paul is a familiar face to many of our Pi Alpha family and is a regular participant and our anniversary ride-alongs, and even serves as a cycling coach for our trips.
Welcome, Paul. Glad to have you on. Glad you could join us today.
Thanks. Obviously, it's always great to be involved with the Ability Experience. Glad to be here.
Yeah. I want to get started because we've got a lot to unpack with you, just between all of your years and different experiences. But let's start off. Tell us about how you got involved with the Zeta Lambda chapter. What brought you into PiCap and then got you interested in the Journey of Hope?
Sure. It's pretty funny. I had zero interest in being in a fraternity when I was away at college. Wasn't even on the radar, to be quite honest with you. And one of my very good friends in the dorms said, hey, we're going to start a chapter but a fraternity, and we want you to be part of it. I'm like, man, no, I don't want to be part of it. I'm like, I have no interest in that sort of a thing. And he kept hounding me and hounding me and hounding me. And lo and behold, one of my classes came up where we needed to do a social research project. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe this is a good opportunity to see what the fraternity is all about. And at the same time, write this paper about, the social aspects of being in a fraternity. And so finally I relented and I said, sure, let's look into this. But it was really sort of the catalyst was this research project. One thing led to another. I just never realized the potential of what a fraternity could be. And then shortly thereafter, just make a long story short, we started looking at expanding and taking on a national. And there were several groups that came and talked to us at the university. The two most powerful were Pi Kappa Phi, and the president of Fiji came to talk with us because there were some legacies that were on campus at the time. So really what had happened was it didn't matter to me so much either way. I liked both. At the time, the regional manager for Pi Kappa Phi was this great guy. His name was Paul Green. Fantastic. I believe he passed away. But he was just so powerful and so down to earth and so real. And I'm like, wow, I really kind of like this guy. So what had happened was we had taken a vote. There were 40 of us. Several of us abstained from voting because I was whatever you guys want to do, wound up being a split vote, 50-50. So the guys who didn't vote had to make up the deciding factor. In between that time period, we had another talk. Paul Green came back, and he mentioned something about this bike trip across the United States. And at that time, it was called Push America. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, "That's it. That's me. This is what needs to happen." The combination of cycling, going cross country, philanthropic involvement, and working with people with disabilities. I mean, all of it. It was all, this is it. This is what I've been waiting for. And it was almost like it was laid right there for me to be doing that. And so I convinced the guys that had abstained to vote PiCap. We went PiCap, and the chapter was sort of founded there at Cal State Chico. And I was the first and only, I guess, PiCap from Cal State Chico, Zeta Lambda guy, to bike across the country for Journey of Hope.
Well, and so trying to figure out where to go next, but how did you get involved with the first Journey of Hope, your first Journey of Hope? Like, did you reach out to somebody? How did you get on the roster?
Right. So great question. It's kind of a funny story because Paul had told me about this bike trip, but he had no information about it. He's like, I really don't know where you could go for this. He goes, but I see how interested you are. So,
cause it had started, just everybody remember like the 1988 was our first team. So that was, I guess that was the year that he would have come to visit, and you ended up being on the 89 team. So everything was pretty grassroots at that time.
Yeah, it was still grassroots, and the Northern Route, I was on the first year of a Northern Route because the original 88 route started in San Diego. The 89 route started in San Francisco, which it remains to date. But so I had made a phone call to, at the time, it was the push office. Got a hold of the phone number through the fraternity, and then called and just said, you know, I'm interested in this sort of a thing. And at the time, there was a combination. I think it had moved to the national office, but Jimmy Karlovec was running it out of his dorm room. That first year, everything was run out of the dorm room at Bowling Green. And they sent me out a packet. I sent all this information in, you know. I wound up talking to Sally Schaefer, now Sally McArdle, who ended up being executive director for a few years of Journey of Hope. I mean, of the Ability Experience. And she was the first person that I actually made contact with, and she did the first phone interview. And we had a really great conversation. Now, I was a bit, if you think I'm eccentric now, you should have seen me back then. The second conversation was with Jim Karlovec, and for whatever reason, he took me the wrong way. He did not want me on the team at all. And Sally had to convince him, I think probably because one, I had raised the money, and two, that we needed people on the team just to make the team complete, and we would work out the problems on the road. And so Jimmy relented. I would say that for the first 3 weeks, he absolutely hated me. I want nothing to do with me. And then he realized how charismatically wonderful I am and what a great human being I am. And all of a sudden, we've been best friends ever since. And that's the truth. To this day, Jimmy is one of the, I revere him probably the most. And we share a very great friendship. But it was so funny because at the time he just thought, oh, man, this is going to be a troublemaker. I'm going to have an issue with this guy. And it was mainly because my extroverted personality at the time. I was very outspoken and that sort of a thing. But I was pretty harmless at the end of the day. I really didn't do anything that was that bad other than just speak my mind. So, yeah, so that's how that sort of came about. And I can remember to this day, talking to a couple guys in my fraternity, and I'm like, look, shave the side of my head. Let's throw some dye in it. Let's go in there and just totally mess these guys. They're going to think that they totally got the wrong guy. You know, that was just me. That was my sarcastic slam at the man, so to speak. So I went in there just completely. I had a dog collar on my neck. I was all kind of goofy stuff. And they're just like, oh, and the looks on their faces was priceless because it was Sally, Jim, and Ken Kaiser at the time. And they were just like, uh-oh, you know, we're going to have problems. And it wound up being nothing. But it was just really funny because it was all shock value. And, you know, I mean, one of the funnier experiences is, you know, the debriefing was, or the briefing was nowhere near what it was in 1989. It was like a half hour the night before. Yeah, all right. You know, at the time, no helmets. You could wear a Walkman. I mean, there was, you want to talk about, you know, there were really no rules. And there weren't too many friendship visits. That was, so the trip in 89 was so drastically different than the trip in 2005.
How big was your team in 89?
It was a pretty big team. I want to say there was 17, 18 riders, something like that. And then three crew. And well,
so you did have support.
We had support, but interestingly enough, Jimmy was the project manager as well as being a cyclist. So he would literally stop at phone booths on the route that we were riding and call ahead to make sure that our lodging was taken care of for the next day. So John Pierce was driving and Sally was driving. And then we had one other van driver at the time. And that was it. You know, we just essentially it was two vans on the road. And they were leapfrogging the whole time. And there was no sweeps or anything like that. It was just like, you know what? You get these little cards with directions and, you know, figure it out. And a lot of times directions were wrong, you know. An 80-mile day. well, an 80-mile day would turn into a 160-mile day. Like, literally, that was that far off. Or we'd be on a road, and the road would just completely dead end. And then we'd have to backtrack 20 miles and then go around. Like, it just, you know, there was a lot of that a lot of the growing pains of an early project. But it was so much fun that nobody cared. Like, what's the, you get to a point where we had done, there was one stretch in that first year, I'll never forget it. It was 7 to 8 days of 100+ miles, day after day after day after day. And the last day was like a 98-mile day. And we're like, oh my God, we got a break. Like the 2 miles, right? But it made a difference. Like, it made a mental difference. But we got so good at riding 100 miles that we actually got good at riding 100 miles. Yeah, it was very strange. Very strange with that. But I really got away from your question, which I forgot now.
Well, no, I just, yeah, how you got started with your first Journey of Hope? And I definitely want to compare and contrast the experiences of different years.
Sure.
And with, just to start off, you know, the first 3 years that you did in sequence, 89, 90, and 91, I mean, were you undergraduate for all three of those?
No.
Okay.
I was... 91, I had graduated.
Okay. So what?
No, that's, I guess, not true. That's not true. No, I was an undergraduate. No, that's not true.
You graduated 1993, right?
I graduated in 93. That's right. Well, I had to think about it because of the transferring schools and the programs. I was supposed to graduate in 91, but by switching back to, they wouldn't let me graduate because I had to take X amount of classes at the university in order for them to give me a degree from the university. So I had to sit
Which
there.
This was at the University of Illinois at Chicago?
At Chicago, yeah. So I had to sit there and just take garbage classes. I had already had enough to get my undergraduate degree. My bachelor's was already done. And they're like, no, you got to sit here and take classes. So, I mean, I was just taking random classes.
Well, but for those first 3 years, your first 3 years of Journey of Hope, what did you see change? Like, what were the biggest things that you noticed progress in the logistics, the planning, the team, the friendship visits, maybe, like, in that three-year period?
Well, it didn't get any better.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, well, and I'll explain. In 89 was by far the most epic year. There was so much looseness that you really got to see who you were as a person. Like, I could remember there would be days where, you know, we would be like in Nevada on the loneliest road. And we knew, you know, you're going to ride 80, 90 miles. You're not going to see a damn thing. And so, like, we could actually get up early and take off early. And so I would do that. And I would ride by myself for hours and hours and hours. And it was the most liberating feeling I could ever describe to you. It was magnificent. It was magnificent. 1990 was more logistically solid. Like, the
more
route
structured.
Was starting to get more structured. There were more friendship visits, which was another aspect that we really didn't experience that much of in 1989. It was more like, can we get these guys across the country in one piece? Can we do that? You know, and then once we realized we could do that, then they started adding in different events and that sort of thing. And that made a whole different feel to the project. You know, it was more internally individualized in 1989. In 1990, it was more, there was still a lot of that because things still weren't ironed out quite as well. But it was like, this is, there's a bigger purpose other than ourselves now. And we started to realize that in 1990. We're like, wow, we can actually affect people. We can make a difference. Like, that really wasn't as powerful in 89.
In that second year, did you already have recurring sponsors? Like, did you stay at some of the same places that you did the year prior?
Yeah. Yeah. We still had, like, and some of them have still stayed to this day.
Right.
You know, there's still some of them there. The interesting thing about those 2 years, and it no longer continued, but I was actually a team captain. They don't have captains anymore. But that was like, they would pick captains sort of on-road people that if there was an issue, go to this person. And then it was up to the captain to go figure things out on the road. There's no longer that delineation.
Well, we have Paceline captains, right. Which is it's more so for those are the strong cyclists that are, you know, in charge of their Paceline kind of for the day, and so that's a little different. But
these were captains for the entire year,
right?
So like, you know, I was it, and me, and then Dan Dawson was another captain at the time, and then. So the structure started to come into, like, it was being molded, essentially, for lack of a better word. Things were really starting to fall into place. Project manager was now in a van, going ahead of the teams and making sure the logistics were all taken care of, you know?
And then 91, that was when we had two routes for the first time, correct?
Two routes for the first time, and 91 was a complete disaster. We spent more time in U-Hauls moving from place to place. So what initially happened, and I could give specific names, but what initially happened was there was a guy on the northern route that supposedly drove the first half of the southern route it started in San Francisco. So supposedly drove from San Francisco to Dallas, Texas. And routed us on the trip. He never did that. He just looked on a map and put us on interstate like 90% of the way, and nobody checked him. So we get out there and we're like, wait, we can't do this. So like literally every day we were making things up as we went along. They routed us. This will never happen again. And it was epic, but they routed us over Yosemite. So we went over Tioga Pass. We stayed up at the top of Yosemite. We biked up the mountain, which you're not supposed to even bike up there. The rangers let us in, and then they stopped us and told us we had to shuttle to get to our campsite. We get to the campsite. We really don't have any camping equipment. It's freezing. It's so cold. It's snowing. And like, we're just like, this is just unbelievable. The next day we're at it. I take that back. We come down off the mountain 2 days later. We're in the middle of Death Valley at 130 degrees. It was unbelievable. Like, this stuff would never happen, but we had no route. And we were literally me, the project manager at the time, Bob Nikolai, who was a crew member the year before, would sit down, and every night we'd go over a route and say, well, what do we do? Well, let's try and go here and see what happens. You know, like, it was literally that bad. There was no, we'd show up to places that they'd be like, who are you guys? When we rode through Death Valley, I remember we stopped at a phone booth, and Bob called John Pierce, who was in the office at the time. And John and I started talking. He's like, what's it like? I said, John, it's 128 degrees. It's ridiculous out here. Like, we really shouldn't be on the road. And so they had a school that we were supposed to stay at in the middle of Death Valley. Well, this school wasn't at school. It was one of these stainless steel Airstreams that had no air conditioner. And we opened the door, and it must have been a blast of like 200 degrees coming out of this thing. And we're like, I look at Bob, and I'm like, no way, man, no way. So we get back on, and we see there's a sign 10 miles up the road. There was a town of some sort. And I'm trying to think of the name of the town off the top of my head. Something Springs. I can't think of the name of it off the top of my head. And we bike to this place, and and we're coming in, and all of a sudden, in the middle of the desert, there's an 18-hole golf course. It's green. It's like, what is going on? So Bob and I walk in. We have no money at the time, because there was no money on the PICAP card, so we couldn't just get money. So the team was broke. The project was broke at that point. So we go in and we pitch the owner And I just said, look, here's the deal. And I explained the situation. And he's like, I'll give you guys two rooms for free. There's air conditioning. Just get out of the sun. Just get out of the sun. And so we did. I mean, there was stuff like that where we would roll into a town. They didn't know who we were. We'd have to change and go pitch for free meals and try and get stuff for free. I mean, we were living day to day, quite literally. It was guerrilla style. It was like if nothing was planned, and here you go. Just take off, you guys. Good luck. You know, because that's kind of what it was like. At one time, one of the kids' parents donated $3,000 so we could feed the team for a couple days. I mean, it was bad. It was a bad scene. And the unfortunate problem is it all came down on the project manager's head, which he had nothing to do with because at the time he wasn't doing the logistics. Like, it wasn't his job to do the logistics. So I felt so bad for what they did to this poor guy because, like, it was their fault. It really was. It wasn't checked. That wasn't his job to check it at that time. So things were like roles were still being defined. I think 91 was the greatest worst year I've ever had because, you know, like I said, we probably rented U-Hauls maybe 15 to 20 times that summer to shift from road to road to, oh, look, we can get free food over here. Okay, everybody in U-Haul, we're going to shift up this way. We're going to bike this way to get to this town. Like, it was literally stuff like that.
But it's still, you still had some sense of feeling that brought you back year after year after year.
Well, I knew that was a fluke situation. You know, I knew that there was obviously a problem. So ironically, I don't know how we make it to Texas, but we make it to Texas, right? We get to Dallas. Coming into Dallas, we wreck one of the vans. It's just like, what is, you know, one of the vans slipped off into a ditch, and we had a farmer pull it out with a truck. A tractor pulled a trip. I mean, it was crazy. There was so much stuff going on, and we're like, what else is going to happen next? And at that point, from Dallas onward, Sally Schaefer had done the route, and that was perfect. Like, it was complete turnaround from what it was. All of a sudden, you know, the first night we're at the Dallas Cowboy Stadium, being given a tour by one of the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders. They give us a bunch of footballs. We're down on the field kicking field. I mean, it was incredible. And then that evening, we're at Texas Ranger game. And we ride on the warning track and we come down first base and, you know, Nolan Ryan comes out and gives us a check for like $5,000. And, you know, that night we're in our hotel room and there we are on ESPN. And it was just like, what happened? You know, it just went from that to this, you know, it was just complete in utter chaos, you know.
And this was still 2001, right? Or sorry, 1991.
This is 91. So it was just such a weird year, you know, but everything logistically from Dallas onward was perfect. There was no problem. Yeah, but it was just it was like that whole first half of the trip was like, you know, I mean, daily guys were talking about going home, like this is garbage, you know, and it didn't seem from a cyclist perspective. And I know there's varying perspectives on this, but from a cyclist perspective, there didn't seem like there was much support from the office at that time. It seemed like it was our fault that this was happening. It was really weird.
That's when you just kind of just figure out, or I mean, it's kind of crucial that stuff like that happens early on, because I mean, where it's at now, I mean, in comparison to your 2005 Journey of Hope, how much of all the logistics, all the planning, all of the That's sponsorships,
right. Yeah,
it's, I mean, it's a I wouldn't say flawless system, but it's like, I mean, the experience I have with kids these days, I wouldn't say kids, they're young gentlemen. Their mile is different, but they also have small things that they pick up on, but nothing compared to some of your experiences. I mean, you guys are really roughing it through.
Well, it was quite literally that, you know, and I think, but again, that's why I found those early years fascinating, because even though it was absolutely ridiculous, it really set us up for adversity and how to handle adversity and how to keep it together. Even with guys that you didn't like on your team, you still found a way to like, okay, we're in this together. We really gotta, you know, figure this one out. I remember we didn't, it was unscheduled, but we decided that we would just, because we were close, we were going to stay at a campground in the Grand Canyon. And we got stuck there for 3 days with no showers. So we ride in the Grand Canyon, we set up camp, and the only place that was available was near a heliport where they do the Grand Canyon tours. So every morning at 6 a.m., we'd hear the helicopters would, you know, just wake us up. And we made the unfortunate mistake of being under sap trees. So sap on our bikes, sap on our uniforms, sap in our clothes, sap in our hair. And we didn't have showers. Like, you could literally take your hair and make a fist and it would just stay there. Like, it was just so disgusting. And then we had to ride, to Flagstaff before we can get a shower. So it was like, you know, a 60-mile ride after 3 days of being under a sap tree. And the reason we had 3 days there is because we had to shuttle ahead, and that put us ahead of schedule. So we had to get back on schedule, so we had to wait a couple days. It was just, yeah. It was crazy.
And so it, for me, it's always fascinating to hear about the first few years of Journey of Hope, because it, I know what logistically goes into Journey of Hope now, and I can't imagine not having historical reference to start a trip across the country. And, if, and I mean, in 91, you only had 2 years, not to mention Bruce's ride just kind of on his own in 87.
But, which was a different route altogether.
Right, but I just
couldn't
even
rely on that.
Exactly. So different sponsors, different cities you're going through, but at least there was the principle of getting from point A to point B. But I know one person, well, two, with Jim Karlovec, is just a whole different deal than an entire team. I know after 91, you took a 7 year gap till your 98 trip. What differences did you see at that time with your, as well as your 2003 and 2005 trips? Well, what had changed in that gap, okay, logistically, so, and just like, yeah, well, how did the trip look different?
You have to understand that 98 was the first year they did a Bruce Rogers route. So I really pioneered the North route, the South route, and the Bruce Rogers route, or the anniversary route. Or
the Transamerica route now.
The Transamerican route now. But at the time, it was the Bruce Rogers route. And so that was, again, all new. So everything was new.
That's right. That's you know? So that's why you came back in 1998.
Right. I came back because I'm like, wow, this is a whole new route. I'll check this one out. You know, I'll see what this is about. You know, again, you know, ignorance is bliss. Yeah. And so the thing about that route, it was a much smaller team. I think there were 10 guys, 11 guys total. So it was a very small team. So less stuff to worry about and go wrong. But it was, I don't think we saw a day of sun, and it was cold. I mean, it was really cold that first year. I mean, there was, you know, snow, hail, all kinds of stuff. I mean, we went through, which I think they still do, Yellowstone, and then into the Grand Tetons. We had logistically, it was a different ballgame. Things were pretty much set up. There's only one time we really needed to improvise, and that was coming out of Yellowstone. And improvise we did. We end up getting log cabins on Coulter Bay, just outside of Jackson Hole, and we managed to get a free meal cooked for us, and it was actually quite good. But we had to improvise because we were supposed to camp out, but there was like 3 feet of snow in the campsite, and it was just, and all our camping equipment was leaking. So we realized that in Idaho at McKinsey Bridge, when it rained on us and we woke up completely soaked. I mean, we were just, everything was wet. There are sleeping bags, everything. So like the equipment that we had wasn't exactly the best. And in fact, there was one point on the trip where we shuttled ahead to Coulter Bay. And the next morning was a day off anyway, so they decided that they would go back and ride the part that we missed from the end of Yellowstone to Coulter Bay. And I don't know why I was. Oh, I had a fever. That's why I wasn't on the bike that day. But what happened was is on the way there, the bike rack broke, and five bikes hit the deck at 65 miles an hour, and a bunch of them got messed up, and there was no insurance for those guys, and it was bad news. So there was no bike shops. I mean, it was just bad. That was a bad day. But that was really it as far as that trip went. Otherwise it was pretty amazing. It's pretty spectacular, actually. But you know, as far as adversity, that was it, you know, and that was the only time we had to make a modification to lodging. But from a logistical standpoint, it was more fine tuned, because at that point, the project manager at the time was doing the logistics. Dave Dries, phenomenal project manager. A great guy, too. Like, just, it was a very, the 98 team was a more mature team. Like, older guys, you know, it was more about, hey, let's just get up, let's get this job done, let's move on. You know, that sort of a thing. And it was great. There really wasn't much partying. There wasn't much, you know, we did see Pearl Jam, we'll say that, in, what do you call it? We were at Missoula, and the night we got in after a ride, and we were at this, one of our sponsors was a bar restaurant type thing. And I was talking to the wait staff, and he's like, oh yeah, man, Pearl Jam is coming into town. I was like, really? Can we get tickets? He's like, well, I can get a bunch of tickets. I'm like, well, how much are they? He's like, $10 a piece. I'm like, here's $100. Give me 10 tickets. And he got 10 tickets, and we went to go see Pearl Jam. it was great. And the next day was a day off, and then we were out. So, yeah, so some interesting stuff.
Well, and then, so just to round things off, you came back 2003, 2005, and then in the middle of that, you did Gear Up Florida in 2004. You know, how would you compare and contrast the Gear Up Florida experience to your previous Journey of Hopes, and then also those more recent Journey of Hope experiences?
Okay, so let's talk about 2003, best team I've ever been affiliated with, holistically, up and down, project manager, cyclists. You know, I was one of the older guys on the team at that time in 2003, and we had a kid that just graduated college, Dave Neal. He was the youngest guy on the team, and these guys all up and down the board were admirable. I can't even begin to tell you. Dave, the project manager, what's his last name? Man, he's from Ames, Iowa.
Addicts? Is it Dave Addicts?
Yeah, Dave Addicts. Dave Addicts never had to wake us up. We literally got up before we were supposed to get up and had everything packed and ready to go every single day. It was like this team was just motivated. And at the time, you could do pace lining. And I mean, we were knocking out 100-mile days in 4.5, 5 hours. I mean, we were just, everyone was dedicated. It was just even the less skilled guys were pushing their limits. And everybody worked with everybody. There was virtually no incidences in general. The best group of cyclists, the funnest group of guys, no real nonsense at all. It was just a really strange team with varying ages of varying generations and varying experiences. And the irony is, I think the team, I'm trying to think of how many guys were on the team, maybe 18, somewhere in that ballpark, maybe. But like 6 or 7 of them are doctors now. I mean, it was a rock star team. Like, everybody was fantastic, you know? And it was really a great year, 2003, probably the best experience that I've ever had on Journey of Hope. Of course, that was the Trans-American route too. So in 2003, that was Trans. The Gear Up Florida in 2004 came up because, my van driver at the time, I'm forgetting everybody's name. Boy, this age thing is really sucking.
Your van driver from Trans 2003?
From 2003, Biggs, Jason Biggs, and Jeff Perlman, who became the project manager of Gear Up Florida 2004, were in my ear about doing this little guppy ride that I used to call it, is it's not really, it's not a ride. It's kind of a, you know, a walk around the park or something. Yeah, I gave it no credit at all. I was just so like, look, if you're going to do it, you go all the way. I don't want to hear any of this crap. People saying that they're pi alphas and they do guff. That doesn't count. You know, it doesn't count. You got to live it, you know, but they had convinced me that, you know, I should experience it from the perspective of the friendship visits. And I got to say, rock on. The hardest logistical thing to put together probably has got to be Gear Up Florida. And the interaction you have with the facilities is priceless, second to none. It was definitely worth it. Like the cycling element is not really that much of an element, you know, particularly in 2004, because if we weren't going to make a time schedule, which the schedules were kind of unrealistic, you know, there was a friendship visit in the morning for breakfast, there was a friendship visit at lunch, and then there was a friendship visit in the evening. And like, they would want you to pull off 40 or 50 miles between the first one and then like 70 or 80 miles between the second one, and then still try and make these unrealistic time frames. So there was a lot of shuttling there, but that wasn't, I think Gear Up Florida is more about the experience and dealing with people with disabilities and really embracing that, because that's what I got out of it. Now, it was fantastic to do it with Jason, because he always wanted to ride with me, and we rode together, and that was a lot of fun. But it was a whole different experience. It's very much unlike the Journey of Hope experience. You know, it just happens to have a bicycle involved and friendship visits, but it's just different. It's different. So, did I gain from it? Yeah. And I've even considered going back and doing, if I could, if I was allowed to, I would go back and do Guff again. I wouldn't have an issue with that. It was a whole different experience. Not what I expected at all.
Yeah, I don't think anybody really has that mindset going into Guff, or from an outsider perspective. I know a lot of people who do Guff who think that others think of themselves as, you know, not the official Pi Alpha experience. But until you do it and you hear these stories that these guys have to pull off on a daily basis, you're essentially comprising two months worth of activities into 2 weeks. It's not like it's just because the mileage is different. It's literally everything's in it, and you still have to, it's still humid. It's not like an easy breeze. The biking days are hard.
The biking days are hard. Yeah, you're right. No, it's not an easy trip. And the only negative thing I could say about Guff is just as you're starting to get to develop this team community, it's over. So you never really develop friendships out of Guff the way you do with the Journey of Hope. You know, there's a lot of times when I started a Journey of Hope, there was someone I just butted heads with, you know, 90% of the trip. And then at the end, you're best friends, like to this day. Like, it's so bizarre, because you managed to see each other's perspective. And that's something that Guff doesn't allow on a team level for you to experience, you know, because because of time, you know, there were guys on the team in 2004 that I really wanted to like get to know, like we were starting to become friends, and then you're just gone. Like, I have people come up to me now whenever I'm at some of these events. Oh yeah, we rode Guff together. I'm like, we did, you know, because I can't remember everybody, and especially on Guff, because it was the team size is ginormous. And then to really interact with everybody and get to know them personally is it's different.
Well, let's touch on 2005 first, before we wrap things out, and just kind of go back to comparing and contrasting. But what do you take away from that, your most recent Journey of Hope experience?
Well, you know, 2005 was a whole different ball of wax for me. So many rules and regulations, too many, in my perspective. It made the trip not even enjoyable. There was just everywhere you turned, you did something wrong. It just didn't matter. And I understand why. I understand the legal responsibilities that we have to take. But if you were to compare 2005 to 89, for example, you would be like, yeah, you wouldn't even want to do it. So that was, I just think that it wasn't until like the last week of 2005 that people just chilled out and just did what they were supposed to do. You know, everything was hyper sensitive, and to me, hyper exasperated, you know, As we were talking about before we got on the podcast, you know, I almost got thrown off of that team, you know, and I really didn't do anything that was out of, you know, like the situation. Of course, it revolves around Vegas, which, you know, everything revolves around Vegas, Southern Round. At that time, if you were old enough, you could go have a couple drinks. And that's what we did. The only thing we were guilty of is breaking curfew by about a half hour. But that turned into something that should have never happened. It went from, okay, they dealt out some punishments and, you know, guys had to take a day off the bike, which I don't consider that a punishment. I think it's ridiculous. I think if you want to punish a guy, go make them ride, especially after they drank the night before. That's a punishment, especially in the desert. But you know, they said, okay, here's what we're going to do, and this is how we're going to end it. And fine. Thought that was the end of it, you know, and it wasn't. It kept coming back up because they had threatened some of the guys on the team that they were going to kick them off the team, and they freaked out, and then they exasperated stories, and they turned them into something else because they didn't want to get kicked off the team. So the irony of this whole situation was that there were a group of guys on the team, and this was fairly regularly, that, like clockwork, they would take certain days off because they'd go out the night before and have a little too much fun, and then say they were sick the next day. And, like, there were guys that would do it on Tuesdays. There were guys that would do it on Thursdays. Like, that's how this, like, because of the rules and regulations, guys were just making stuff up. And they saw what happened to us, so they were like, well, we'll just avoid it by doing this. So, okay, it's your turn to go out tonight. Okay, it's your turn. Like, it was goofy. So it really wasn't. When I remember talking to Chad Coltrane after I finished the trip, and he's like, do you think you would come back and do it again? I said, absolutely not in this version. There is no way. And you know, thankfully, the reins have been lightened a lot. Because remember, at that time, like, a two-man pace line was as far as you can go. Like, you couldn't do a three-man or a four-man pace line. It was only two-man. Like, it was really hardcore. And they were so adamant about keeping everybody together that you literally would ride maybe 2 or 3 miles and have to stop and wait for everyone to catch up. And then you ride maybe 5 or 10 miles, then stop and wait. So you never, never made a goal. We never made a full day of riding. I remember one day they said, okay, guys, we got 100 miles to do. You got 3 hours to do it in. Like, the guys are like, why are we even riding? Like, seriously, like, even a professional rider couldn't do that. What do you, how do you even get people motivated to get on the road when you say something like that? So I think there was a fundamental problem with the project manager. I think there was a fundamental problem with the rules and regulations were just unrealistic for what you experience on the road. And I think right after that, it wasn't much longer after that, the rules started to change where they started to adapt things and make it at least, you know, okay, yeah, this is safe and realistic, you know. Coincidentally, I think one of the smartest things that has ever come out of that are the ankle bracelets, and sort of these, I like the idea of the deltas, you know, the
safety triangles.
The rear triangles.
Yes, yeah. I call them the ass deltas because they hung off of our asses. And I think there's a way to incorporate that actually into the uniform.
Which is actually what we've done now. But we
did, is it
but,
now? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
high vis. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's important. And I think those are the great things that came out of that. You know, so like the whole development of the Journey of Hope has, and Guff to that, it's been a process, and it's been constantly massaging and changing. You know, I think the biggest and the strangest thing to me is this project hasn't blown up to something ginormous at by this time, you know, and I don't know where the problem lies with that, but it seems to me like it should be a much bigger project than it actually is. Now, I don't know if that would change the experience for the guys riding or not. But I'm just surprised that we only raise X amount of dollars. You know, it should be, it seems like there should be a lot more with all the context we have, with all the Pi Alphas that have come and gone, what, over 2,000, you know, that there should be some inroads somewhere to somebody that has bigger funding, you know? So, and I think that that's, you know, if we want to talk about that side of things, I think that there's an element that, that's been missing for a long time. And I think there needs to be an actual position for public relations for Pi Alphas. You know, and it's somebody that actually just gets the Pi Alphas involved on a regular, there's 2,000 of us out there. You know, and when we do an anniversary ride, 40, 30 show up, if you're lucky. If you're lucky. I mean, come on. You know, like, and it's usually the same guys. It's all the guys from the earlier years that show up. You know, and we're like, how come we can't get guys to come back? You know, why aren't guys coming back for this? This is, it's the greatest thing you could ever do. It was a gift to be part of any of these teams, even in a limited capacity. You know, it's a gift. Why wouldn't you be, you know, coming to these events and supporting this absolutely unique and amazing project? I'll never understand that one. Never get it. So anyway, yeah, that was the 2005 experience. Again, every year I've learned something new about myself, and that's one of the great things that JOH does. It teaches you something about who you are. And whether it's a good experience or a bad experience, you still learn something positive, and it's something you can carry away the rest of your life.
Paul, I don't think we even touched on this, and I'm not even sure if I know the answer, but because I know what career path you chose, but were you always a cyclist, or did you always have the athletic abilities? And did that also change your perspective of what you wanted to make a career out of?
Well, the journey of hope led to bicycle racing. Okay, so I would say that as a child, in high school, I was a multiple sports athlete, but I really didn't lock into cycling. There were a couple poignant times in my life. When I was a teenager, I saw the Iron Man, the real Iron Man on TV, and I was just blown away, and I thought, wow, well, you want to talk about testing who you are as a person. So that was the first thing that led me towards cycling, and I got a road bike at that point and started riding, but it wasn't until I went to Chico, and it turned out that dorm mate across the hall, he was a cyclist, avid cyclist, and he would take me on these rides, and, you know, and slowly but surely, I just started really falling in love with being on the bike. So having some form of athletic background, track and field and ice hockey, I moved into cycling, and I really pursued that for 10 years, right after JOH. And I pretty much made that my life. So I moved everywhere and did all these bike races and that sort of a thing. The irony is that we were talking about is when I was at the University of Illinois Chicago and I was taking these random classes, I took one class in exercise physiology and I was blown away and I was like, this is what I should have been studying. This is exactly what I should have been studying because I really got into, well, what's happening to my body? What are these transitions that are going on? What am I actually feeling when I'm feeling miserable? What's, you know, on a cellular level. So when I had left cycling, I started another business, and then I went back and got my master's degree in exercise science. And that led me, which again, that was more, I went back and got that degree. The master's is more of a personal knowledge. Like, I wanted to understand why I was super fit, but I wasn't really that great of a cyclist. I was a mediocre Cat 2, and, you know, with a VO2 max over 75, which, if you know anything about that, that puts you in the elite category of cyclists. You know, anywhere from 75 to 85 is pretty, that's professional level. So cardiovascularly speaking is really good, but I just really wasn't a good cyclist. Maybe it's just genetics or whatever, but I went back to my master's program to kind of understand, well, what was going on. And as a result of going through that master's program, I had my other business running at the same time. It was successful enough so that I could focus on studies. I got an internship with a facility that trains indoor triathletes for outdoor events. And one thing led to another during this internship, and I wound up running the facility when the owner took a bunch of people to California for some training, and the DePaul University team was training out of there. So it was just, I would just open the studio for these guys, and we became friends. And pretty soon they're like, hey, you know, you seem to know a lot about cycling. Maybe you want to coach us. And one thing led to another. And, you know, in that first season, I took a lot of the rules and things that I had learned from either my former coaches or books that I had read or my actual master's degree program, pieced together a team, and they were, the Midwest region had 45 cycling teams. We were training all indoor because it's freezing in Chicago. And we went from 45th to 3rd in the conference. We had a bunch of regional champions come out of that team, men and women. And, you know, no one could figure out how we were doing it with no budget because I was volunteering my time and we were actually training them. DePaul wouldn't let us train at their university. We had to go train somewhere else. I trained where I got my master's degree at Northeastern. They let me come in with the team and train them. And the rest has sort of led me down this road to where I am today with cardiovascular testing, training, and all that sort of thing. So that's how that sort of developed.
Well, and as we start to wrap up here, I mean, we always talk about Pi Alpha moments. You know, it's kind of like the Pi Alpha thing of like, that's when you realized, I don't know, that the trip was impacting you, or that you were at a particular friendship visit and had a relationship, you know, kind of met someone and kind of connected. Do you have something that pops out? I mean, you've got so many days on the
there's so many
to think back on. Yeah. Can you narrow it down to one or two?
Well, there's so many epic days.
What was the one that brought you back year after year?
There isn't one. No, there isn't one, because there's so many things. It's a combination of the impact. Well, I have to say one of the strongest and most powerful didn't occur to me in the first couple of years, but the power of the friendship visits and the impact that we would make, and the impressions that would be left, you know, like I remember leaving some of these facilities and the kids were just grabbing us and they're crying and they don't want you to leave because, you know, they have never experienced anything like it. I mean, the gift that you're giving, you know, we would talk about this on the bike when we're really suffering and say, hey, remember that facility that we were just at where these kids, you know, they can't walk. They can't even ride a bike. We have the privilege to suffer. And that would just shut everybody up. And we would just put our heads down, suffer away, and just do it. Because that's what's important. We were there for there was a bigger mission other than us. Initially, it was about us. Initially, on those first couple teams, you would have loved these guys, Zort, because they were racers. Like Jimmy raced, I raced, Chris Lobby raced. Like there were like six or seven, Jason and all these guys from the first year, Rick Guest, they all raced. We were all racers. So like, you know, every day was a you know, who gets there first? You know what I mean? And it was, I mean, we would just hammer out these rides, you know, but then we'd have nothing to do. Like there were no friendship visits really set up. So, you know, my big thing in those early years was to get on the bike and get there as fast as I could, because that means I can go back to sleep again, because I wanted to sleep, because I really, really wanted to sleep. So I would ride the, you know, whatever, 80, 90 miles, get there on my own, get into lodging, shower, and I'd be completely sleeping, you know, and guys would be rolling in like 3 or 4 hours later, because a lot of guys at the time, you could just stop and hang out. Like I remember we'd be riding through some of these small towns, and you guys know this, there's like a little square in these little towns. There's always a square, right? And you come riding up and you'd see a pair of shoes laying on the ground and some guy passed out on a bench, just snoring away, you know, because it's like 7:30 in the morning and we've been on the bike for an hour and a half, you know, and they're just completely knocked out. You're like, oh yeah, there's Mike. You just keep going, you know, It's really funny. But that wasn't answering your question. So the, you know, there are poignant moments. We spoke about one earlier, but it's really quite intense. And the best way I could describe this experience is Zen moment, flow. If you know anything about flow in sports, this is probably one of those situations that they describe when they talk about high intense situations, very high intense situations. And essentially the bottom line was, is we were coming, we were in 91, we were in Yosemite, and we were coming off the top of the mountain first thing in the morning. And you have to understand that we had been climbing for like 4 or 5 days straight to get to the top of this mountain. And it was the first time we saw one of those little truck signs with the, you know, pointing down. And we're like, oh, right? So I think there was four of us. We start sprinting. And we were already going fast. We start sprinting to hit this thing because we want speed, because that's what we're about. And at the time, you know, and we start screaming down the side of this mountain. And I'm looking down and I'm walking and I'm looking at my the little bike computer speedometer. Yeah, no. And it's like, you know, 45, 50, 55, 60, 65, 70. And I'm like, holy crap. You know, like 70 miles an hour and it's still rising. 71, 72, 73. And at that point, I thought, okay, I'm feeling the bearings in the bike hub rattling around. And I'm like, this is probably, I need to somehow slow myself down. So my first thought initially is to sit up a little bit and let the air catch your chest. That's because that's one way to kind of slow yourself down. Well, where we were is, you know, there was a cliff, a substantial cliff on one side, guardrail, and then the side of the mountain was right here. So the road was kind of carved in the wall. And thank God there were no switchbacks. It was just sort of winding like this. Because if there were switchbacks, it would have been over for about half of us. We'd have went right off the side. So when I did that, there was, it was swirling in this can. And I started doing like this kind of stuff. Your body's bouncing around. Yeah. And I said, oh, can't do that. So I go back into the tuck position. I said, okay, I'm going to try and feather the brake. Now at the time, Rich Green was a van driver behind me at the time. I tapped the brake and the bike just started jumping like this. And I could feel everything going this way. I was going down on my right side. I could feel it. I could see it. And I'll explain what Rich had seen when this had happened from behind. Because he was tracking me at like 65, 70 miles an hour. He was right behind me. So as I'm going down, everything gets completely dark and I go right into like this tunnel vision, just real tight tunnel vision. And I look up and I could see the guardrail, and on the guardrail, I could see the nut, and on the nut that's holding the guardrail together, I could read the company that made that nut that was holding. And that was a good 15 feet away. Like I could see everything clearly. And then I kind of glanced up and I saw a bee flying, and I could see and hear its wings in slow motion. You could hear everything. I saw a dandelion on the other side of the road. I could smell it. And then things started going black and white, like or dark and like flashes of just what was happening in the moment. And then I felt the whole side of my right body just heat up. And I thought, okay, I'm hitting the pavement. Like I literally thought I was, that this was the pavement. My body's, whatever's going to happen now, I'm dead, you know? And in that split second, I can't even begin to tell you what happened or what adjustment happened or whatever happened, but it felt like this warm sensation just set me right. And I kept going. And, you know, later when I talked to Rich, in the van, he's like, Paul, he goes, I have no idea how you're not dead. He goes, there was so much sparks and gravel being kicked up behind your bike, and it was jumping all over the place. I have no idea how you held that. And so this, you have to understand, this was a very, very long descent, like probably 15 miles of descending. And so I was so scared I wasn't going to do a damn thing other than stay in the tuck position, hold the bars, and pray to God I didn't crash. We were passing up motorcycles at 60 miles an hour. I couldn't stop. I was passing traffic. So we'd roll into the other lane and then roll right back. I mean, it was just so frightening. And so we get to the bottom. You know, I think one guy hit 74. I hit 73. And we were all just, like, we were hurting so bad because you're in that tuck position and you're not used to staying there. And it was probably a good 30 minutes of just like this. So your shoulders were fried. Your arms were fried. All your senses were all over the place. And we just kind of looked at each other and, you know, and some asshole goes, yeah, let's do it again. You know, right. You know, but we were both, I mean, we all admitted later that that was probably the scariest experience ever. Ever. And I don't necessarily ever want to go back to that. You know, those are speeds that were just, it was a little crazy, especially for JOH and especially for the skill level that we were at that time. You know, we weren't, now, even though we had experience, we weren't very skilled. So that is not a reason why I would come back and do JOH. But it really is the dynamics of the team. It is the ability to have somebody tell you what to do on a daily basis and where to go, and then to fulfill that mission, really gives your day meaning. It's that. It's the opportunity to be a child again without being a child. You know, I would have no problems going back. And if you guys have known that I've done all the anniversary ride-alongs from what do you call it? And you also probably know that I usually ride from Chicago on my bike to these events. And then I usually fly back. So wherever I'm at in the country, I usually bike there and pick up Pi Alphas along the way. And we kind of ride together and stay in, you know, a little bit nicer accommodations than what we're used to, you know. But we, you know, the point is we ride back and then we do these events. And it's just a great way to reconnect with the Pi Alphas along the way. Yeah, maybe there's some sort of a fundraiser in there, Gary. I don't know. But, you know, I think it's a great way because, you know, when I'm riding, I mean, I'm picking up people along the way. You know, four or five people are in my path. Wouldn't be too hard to organize something like that to use it as a fundraising event.
Yeah.
But
absolutely. But, yeah, I mean, that's some powerful stuff. I can't say I can relate with being close to death in a situation like that, but I know what you mean when it comes to athletic focus. I mean, I can think back even something as simple as being on the wrestling mat in high school. I just was tunnel vision. Like, I couldn't hear any of my coaches or anything.
That's right. You're just there.
It's just me, and I don't see anything around me. And that's kind of what I think of when you talk about that. Just like your senses are heightened and things change. But
it's a life changing experience, as I'm sure you know. And there are ways to reach that from what I understand. It's either through these experiences. That's why I love athleticism so much, because you could tap into these other areas. I think any real athlete ends up learning a lot about who they are as a human being. That's what sports is. That's why it's so appealing to me is to be involved in sports. It's not because, oh yeah, jock, whatever. Cause there are a lot of those, you know, but there are a lot of people who have this great experience and never gain anything from it. So that's part of the reason why the Journey of Hope was so powerful for me, that draw me back. I'd go back and do it again if I had the opportunity. I mean, I would, you know, if I knew that they would say, yeah, Paul, you can come back and do it again. Yeah, why not? What the hell? You know, who was the guy who was there in 2019?
Rob Raceman. Probably.
No, not Reb, before Rob Raceman. Previous year.
Mike Stout? Remember,
yeah. Mike Stout. He's the oldest guy to ever do JOH. And yeah. I love that guy. He's just, you know, I remember when he came through Chicago, he's like, Paul, I got to tell you, this is the best time of my life. You know, and I'm like, yeah, I said, I know, man, I get. I said, and I said, even with the age discrepancy, it's just ridiculously amazing. And he's like, I get it, man. He goes, and if I didn't do it, I would have never known. You know, Raceman has had Rob and I are good friends, and he's had plenty of experience on the bike, and he's a cyclist. But Mike was a little bit of a different case. You know, he was a house dad. Yeah, I forget what chapter he's at. You know,
Chapel Hill, like, UNC.
Yeah. Oh, Chapel Hill. That's right. He's right in the area where I work, because I work with NC State. Yeah. And he told me, he goes, man, I was just getting tired of seeing all these guys having a blast. He goes, I really wanted to experience it. And I'm like, man, I'm so glad you did. You know, because I think we need like that sort of age variance to add perspective, you know, to how powerful the Journey of Hope really is.
Well, and to that point, I mean, Journey of Hope, you know, for anybody that's a prospective team member that's listening, I mean, we do our best to try to explain what the experience is, but to Mike's point, there's no way to know what you're going to get out of it until you do it. We realize when we say that, you know, it takes a lot of trust from a team member to put in us that we're going to steer their efforts and give them a good experience. So there's a lot of trust there, but I think, you know, it's just, I've heard it said a lot of different ways, but over the years, it's the same consensus. It's, you can't explain it.
You can't explain it. You can't really quantify it or put it into words. But what I could tell you for me, what it was like is it's like, if you're a religious person, it's damn near religious experience. If you're a religious person, it's like God gives you a tremendous opportunity to see how amazing life can be. And it's in the Journey of Hope. And that project itself is one of the purest forms of spirituality I've ever experienced. Because it is that powerful. If you allow it to be. That's, you know, because everybody can make or break their experiences on the Journey of Hope. Because, I mean, I remember, you know, we've had some guys that would come on the team. And, you know, one guy's big thing was to steal a license plate from every state he was in. Yeah, I mean, just like your priorities are completely off the mark if you come on and do something like it. Because that's not what you're there for. It should be an opportunity to develop as a human being. And I think that this gift, the Journey of Hope gift that PiCap thankfully embraced, has allowed the development of really young adults to manhood.
I completely agree.
It's just, well, I remember, sorry, I just keep digressing because you keep bringing up this great stuff. In the first couple years, you know, in those first few years, I would sit down with some of my friends or we'd talk on the phone, you know, Drew Klee or Mike Dugan or Michael Doring or one of those guys from the early teams, Dave Aukerman and Dan Dawson. These were guys that were my contemporaries at the time. We would sit down and we'd just be like, what did they do to us? Like, because when we tried to enter the working world, we were like, no way. There's just no way we can do this. Like, guys would talk about, you know, they're sitting in their office and they look out the window and they see some guy on a bike and they just about want to die because they're just like, this is the, so it opens you up to the possibilities. It also breaks down the barriers of what you thought you were supposed to be. I'm supposed to go to school. I'm supposed to get a job. I'm supposed to work in this corporate world and I'm supposed to get this kind of insurance and this 401k and all this stuff. Throw it all out the window after JOH. Your life changes. You know, and at the time I didn't realize how powerful it was, but I've learned over the years that I cannot get hired by anybody. Like, I am unhireable. People just don't like me and I interview like an asshole. Yeah, I'm just horrible. Just horrible. And like, so people just don't like me that much. And I don't know why, but they don't. So I've always had to develop my own businesses. Like everything I've done by myself. It's not by choice, I assure you. I would like to have a steady paycheck. I would like to have a good family life. I would like to be on the bike on a regular basis and have routine. And I just don't have that. But it's been just like the journey of hope. My life has been one amazing adventure after adventure after adventure. Good, bad, or otherwise. And what the journey of hope taught me is that you're constantly learning and you're constantly growing. And so therefore, I don't think I was ever meant to be in that corporate environment. I think I was just, I'm meant to keep growing. I'm meant to reinvent who I am and change who I am and adapt to who I am and then share this great knowledge that I have with other people to maybe better their lives. And maybe that's the purpose. Maybe that's all it really needs to be. You know, it's just a simple purpose like that. And I honestly believe that that stems from doing the journey of hope. Is you find a purpose. You find, this is why I'm here.
Yeah, and in that I want to conclude that you can kind of do it at whatever point. It doesn't have to be preferenced in college. You can always come back. It's always very time sensitive to whatever you're going through in life. Everyone's life is a little experience is different. So anyone who made it this far in the podcast, I mean, if you're on the fence at any point and you can't do it right now or logistically, it's just not the time, there's always a time for it later. So, I mean, that's something I think a lot of people can relate to and can come back to time in and time out, or even relate to going to Guff for 2 weeks as opposed to the whole summer, because sometimes these things are hard, or you find other ways to contribute or to rebrand. And like even some of the other podcasts that we've had on, some of the guests that we've had, they've found ways to rebuild and rebrand as they like build brotherhood and then experience another journey, just like how they experienced the first time around.
Well, you know, to your point, I would have to agree 100%. And I think it would be an awful shame if you could exist in the fraternal experience and not experience Journey of Hope at any point. It would really be a shame to miss out on something as spectacular as this event.
I agree. So, but in that, I want to end things. I want to thank you so much for having your time, and I hope that we get to see you out on some more coaching opportunities. At the very least, I hope you still enjoy doing the RTTs and getting involved with some of the young cyclists and continue branding the ways.
Am I supposed to respond to that? Yes, I would love to. I would love to be there. And hopefully I will. I would love to share, you know, my experiences and knowledge, not just, you know, what I've learned on the bike, but just what I've learned in general. You know, on a quick side note, I know COVID was a tough thing for a lot of people. Hit me in various ways. The most traveling I've done was during COVID. I mean, I was literally all over the world. I can't even begin to tell you about that. But my former coach, Eddie B, passed away from COVID. Now, if you know anything about Eddie B, he coached Greg LeMond most of his career. He coached Armstrong as a junior. He started the U.S. Postal Team. He's probably the most decorated cycling coach in the world. In June of 2019, I spent a full month training off of his ranch in San Diego. And every day we would talk about different training techniques and different things that can help cyclists, you know, develop and how to prep for different rides and how to do these things. And I feel very honored to have had that time, because 2 months later he was dead. And it was a very tough, he is closer to me than family is in general. And I considered him a very, very good friend, a very good mentor, an extremely exceptional coach. But the point that I suggest to you is that knowledge that I carry with me is knowledge that I believe he would want me to spread. And that is my intention to do that. And if it manifests itself in the journey of hope, then that would be wonderful.
Oh. Now, Paul, we'll definitely have you keep you involved. And we're so happy to be back on the road this summer. And you know, fortunately, we'll be on the road for many years to come. But just appreciate you taking time again today. Just your perspective is so unique with just the duration and vastly different experiences that you can speak to. So thank you for spending time with us. I'm sure a lot of people and our listeners will be able to connect with some of those things.
Well, Gary, thank you very much. Thorth, you too. I mean, it's, you know, it's great to see you guys, because I haven't seen you guys in a few years. So it is my pleasure. I'm always try to make myself available, right for the moment I'm in Chicago, I'm going to be selling the place here in the next, I'd like to get it sold in the next 2 months, 3 months. Then I have no real place to land. I'm considering Tucson, Arizona, but that's about all that's on the radar right now. So that's where I'm at.
All right, Paul. Well, thanks so much. And Gary, thanks again for helping out on this podcast.
Of course. Thank you, Zorth.